Good morning. May it please the court. Rita Pendry on behalf of Javier Brown. I would like to reserve 3 of my 10 minutes for rebuttal, if I might. Sure. Mr. Brown was convicted of being a part of a conspiracy to import drugs into the District of Columbia and was sentenced to a term of 136 months. In this case, I would submit that there's no dispute about the overriding legal principles that will govern the court's decision. I think the government and the defense agree that the prosecutor cannot vouch for the credibility of his witnesses, that the prosecutor cannot, by argument or questioning, shift the burden of proof in a case, and that the prosecutor cannot use as substantive evidence of the defendant's guilt the guilty pleas of co-defendants. So where we are at odds here is whether on the facts of this case these principles have in fact been violated by the prosecutor at the trial.
I don't think there could be any doubt about that. I think the question is one of prejudice, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, I believe the test is how strong was the government's case, how egregious was the error, and were there any ameliorating instructions by the trial court? And of course, the latter is a separate argument, which I'll get to in a moment. The government's case against Mr. Brown was that, according to Ana Alvarez, she had sold him a kilo of cocaine that she had brought with her from Panama. And it was Ms. Alvarez was one of the witnesses for whom we contend the prosecutor vouched improperly. The other evidence against Mr. Brown was that he came into the district after several telephone conversations with the complaining witness to pick up cash which belonged to the drug dealer in Panama. And the issue then was, did he know what the money was for, and did he know it was drug proceeds, and did he intend to assist the conspiracy in that way? The only evidence that he knew that the money was drug money and that he intended to assist the conspiracy really came from the 404B evidence and from Ms. Alvarez's testimony. The 404B evidence was the man down in Richmond, Mr. Eastman, who testified that in 2002 and 2003 he had been engaged in crack cocaine and heroin drug activity with Mr. Brown. And again, Mr. Eastman's credibility was crucial to this case, and Mr. Eastman was one of the witnesses for whom we contend the prosecutor impermissibly vouched. Other than that testimony, there were a couple of notebooks found in Mr. Brown's car which had phone numbers of co-conspirators in them. There was he had $7,000 of cash money on him. And that's the total of the evidence against him. And so our position is that evidence was certainly not what the government could classify as overwhelming evidence, and that it was conduct like the conduct of which we complain that tipped the balance here. And as far as ameliorating cautionary instructions, there wasn't one. None was requested, but the court didn't intervene, and at no point, either when the evidence was received or at the end of the case, did the court tell the jury, you can't make substantive use of the fact that these co-defendants have pled guilty. And the government's argument really urged the jury to do just that, and its analogy of the train, and the co-defendants have gotten on the train, and Mr. Brown is not on the train, but he should be, basically, it was the argument, and he has the right to go to trial and get found guilty. The co-defendants have pled to their guilt. So the argument was pretty clearly that the co-defendants are guilty, and therefore Mr. Brown's associated with them, and he's guilty too, and the court didn't intervene to tell the jury, no, that's not right, and to tell the jury the proper purpose to make of that evidence, which was, of course, did it reflect on the credibility of the witnesses who were testifying pursuant to the plea agreements. So,
well, there was an instruction about witnesses who have pled.
There was the general credibility instruction at the end of the case.
But it deals specifically with with witnesses who have pled, doesn't it?
That's right, Your Honor. And the court, again, I think that's the standard instruction the court gave, that one of the factors you can look to in deciding whether to believe these witnesses is that they have this cooperation agreement with the government.
It may be standard, but it also may cover the situation.
And that the witnesses pled guilty. But the jury was never told, and I submit they should have been after the argument and the questioning of the prosecutor. The jury was never told. The fact that the co-defendants pled guilty doesn't say anything about whether Mr. Brown is guilty or not. And that's the omission that we submit is so critical here, and that's the omission that we believe left this jury sort of awash as to what to do with this evidence. And when you couple that with the arguments of counsel, we submit that the prejudice is obvious, that Mr.
Yeah, but when you couple that with plain error review, you have a real problem, don't you?
Well, I would not deny that it's an uphill swim, upstream swim.
Everest in the winter.
Perhaps that too, Your Honor. But the factors that the courts enunciated, strength of the case, whether there was any ameliorative instruction that directly addressed the issue.
Well, you had the instruction, as the Chief Judge said. There was an instruction. I mean, you know, the problem, I mean, the reason we have the rule is to avoid sandbagging. I mean, if these errors were errors, it's not like they leap out as positively wrong. They're subtle, and it's a different case if someone objects and then the trial judge does nothing. But you don't have any objection here on anything.
I have to concede that, Your Honor. I wasn't trial counsel, and I can't speculate as to what trial counsel was thinking or not thinking, but there was no objection, and yet, once the prosecutor started making the argument about the train and the co-defendants have gotten on the train and the other examples that we set out in the brief, we submit that it's so clear that the gist of the argument was these people have pled guilty. Now, Mr. Brown's guilty too, but he has a right to go to trial and let you find him guilty.
I mean, the prosecutor starts out, so when you evaluate their testimony, surely you can ask, well, did they do what the government said they did? That seems to be focusing on a quite permissible issue. And then he closes. I ask you, based solely on the evidence, to find the defendant guilty.
And the court says the arguments are not evidence.
Right.
I was frankly a little, I was looking for your ineffective assistance of counsel argument and didn't find one.
Well, Your Honor, I'll leave that for another day, I believe, based on the record here. But I submit that the arguments that counsel made about the pleas, I'm having trouble finding them in my summary right here, but I set them out in the brief.
If you want to deal with that in your rebuttal time.
I will, Your Honor.
Fine.
Yes.
Thank you.
And with that, I will save what minutes I have left. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Leslie M. Gerardo on behalf of the United States. There was no plain error in this case because the government's closing argument, fairly read in context, did nothing more than urge the jury to convict appellant because of the strength of the government's case. And indeed, the government's case was overwhelming. And in fact, most of the facts involving the conspiracy, the existence of the conspiracy, and even the defendant's participation insofar as going down to Washington, D.C. to pick up the money was undisputed.
What do you mean by that?
Well, in his closing argument, defense counsel basically conceded that there was no dispute that the drug organization existed, that Cholo was the head of it, that drugs were coming in from Panama through Miami and New York, and even that defendant himself had gone to Washington, D.C. with the purpose of picking up money for Cholo. The only question that defense counsel raised was what was his intent in so doing. And I would submit that the evidence of intent was also overwhelming, and it was actually there's much more in the record on intent than appellant suggests in this appeal.
Well, the objection is that in context, this repeated claim that that various aspects of the charge are undisputed is a comment on the defendant's a decision not to testify.
I don't believe in the context of this case that the jury would naturally and necessarily have taken that import from the prosecutor's remarks, Your Honor. First of all, again, the evidence was quite strong, and all of these comments, the comments about the evidence being unquestioned largely arose in opening statement before the jury would have had any reason to question whether the defendant was testifying or not. And indeed, in voir dire, at the start of voir dire, defense counsel indicated that defendant might be testifying. So I don't think one could take the remarks at that juncture as suggesting anything about the defendant's right to silence. I think there was maybe one other remark to the using the phrase unquestioned in rebuttal argument, but again, it wasn't made in such a way that the jury would naturally and necessarily take it as a reflection on the defendant's decision not to testify, because the evidence could have been contested in many ways. And indeed, the defense had presented evidence that in part was designed to try to conflict and contest the government's case.
Well, without being there and seeing how this unfolded, it's a little difficult. One can imagine the prosecutor pointing at this defendant sitting silently at the table and repeating this undisputed point.
But I think the court in that regard has the fact that neither defense counsel nor the court thought there was anything objectionable about the argument. They listened, they heard it, they saw what was going on in the courtroom. The court did intervene at points where it felt it needed to, but it certainly did nothing about this argument, which suggests that in context, in the manner in which it was delivered, the court saw nothing inappropriate about the prosecutor's closing.
Well, you even cite a case where the defendant and the complaining witness are said to be doing something normally very private, and yet our circuit said that that could be rebutted by persons other than the defendant.
That's the Monahan case, Your Honor? Yes, that's correct. And I think Monahan goes a long way towards indicating or illustrating why what happened in this case was not problematic.
How about the vouching? I believe also the testimony of all the witnesses, Olivia Williams, Kenrick Eastman, and everyone we call.
As we indicated, the choice of the word "I believe" was inartful and ill-advised.
Chosen several times, though, I'm looking at
if you look at the context in which that comment arose, Your Honor, it really does nothing more than direct the jury back to the evidence. Indeed, the paragraph preceding the paragraph in which the prosecutor used the "I believe" rhetoric says to the jury, "I want you to bring your common sense and everyday life experiences to the jury box. Your common sense and everyday life experiences will tell you whether or not a witness was testifying truthfully, or what we call a ring of trustworthiness or ring of truth." When he then refers to the "I believe," again, it's "I believe that the witness's testimony did have a ring of truth." So while that was...
I'm looking at another passage where... So that's in addition to the passage I'm looking at where I get your common sense and then... Well, there's the ring of truth. Maybe it's the same passage. "I think through the witnesses we have called, that has been borne out. I believe based on the testimony of A, B, and C. I believe the evidence showed that beyond any doubt. I believe the evidence on the testimony of Mrs. Rios. I believe her testimony. I believe also the testimony of all the witnesses." I mean, this is a litany. This sounds like an excellent sermon.
As I indicated, Your Honor, it could have been phrased more artfully. But again,
it could hardly have been phrased more poorly.
Well,
put it this way. If this were not a plain error case, you would acknowledge, I'm sure, that we'd have to reverse.
I think the fact that this is under a plain error standard, obviously, I don't think this rhetoric rises to the level of plain error.
Well, that's certainly the issue here. But let's just start as a platform, whether it wouldn't be reversible error but for that standard of review.
I think that the comments always have to be examined in context.
I think if we examine it in context, if we weren't shielded by the plain error standard here, we would be basically saying, if we didn't reverse this judgment, this is okay, go forth and do it again. And do it as many times as you like.
Again, when you evaluate without the plain error standard, if you're evaluating prosecutorial error, you look at the nature of the misconduct, whether there were corrective actions. There's the test that appellant's counsel cited. I'm not sure that this language, even under that, would necessarily be problematic. It is certainly more problematic under that standard than it is under a plain error standard. What I think saves this somewhat, though, Your Honor, is it's fairly ambiguous. He does refer back to the ring of truth, ring of trustworthiness. So quite frankly, it's unclear what he's saying to the jury, other than I think their testimony has a ring of trustworthiness. I mean, he could say you could find that their testimony has a ring of trustworthiness, and that would be appropriate. So it's on the line. I think it's certainly on the line, but whether or not it went over in the context of and a non-plain error standard, I don't think needs to trouble the court, because I think under the plain error standard, it simply doesn't rise to plain error, both because the comments are fairly ambiguous and also because in the context of this case, the evidence really was overwhelming. And to the extent that he's talking about the testimony of all these witnesses, again, most of that testimony was uncontested in any event.
And again, what do you mean by uncontested?
Because the defense counsel conceded in closing argument that there was a drug organization, that the drugs were coming in through the people who testified.
The issue was his knowledge and intent.
And there was substantial evidence as to his knowledge and intent.
Anybody other than Eastman?
Well, first of all, you have the inference that arises simply from the fact that he was entrusted by the known leader of a fairly extensive drug organization who was in fear of his life if he didn't collect his money. He was entrusted by that man to come down to Washington, D.C. and pick up $47,000. The jury could take a permissible inference from that alone that his intent was to participate in this conspiracy. He had contact with not only the individuals in New York, Anna Rios, who testified that she delivered a kilo of heroin to appellant, but also Alex Barraza, who was responsible for the distribution network in Miami. And yet he testified that he and appellant had telephone conversations relating to Cholo. The substance of those conversations was seemingly innocuous, but the fact that Cholo was using someone in New York or Washington, D.C. to communicate with another Confederate in Miami, again, gives an inference that he's part of the organization. And then, of course, you have the more direct testimony from Anna Rios about his acceptance of the kilo, and you have Kenrick Eastman's 404B testimony indicating that defendant had a long history of involvement in the drug trade, and specifically that he had traveled to Panama on previous occasions in the years before this event. And you have the fact that he had gone to Panama about a month before this, November 18th to December 18th, not even a month before he was arrested, for the purpose of meeting with Cholo. If you put all that together, it's overwhelming evidence that he was part of this drug conspiracy, and therefore the reason that he went to pick up the $47,000 was to deliver it to Cholo as payment for the drugs.
Who was he picking it up from?
He was picking the drugs up from Melson Shasha, a.k.a. Gregory Fulton.
Do we know anything about, do we have anything from him?
Well, all we have from him, Your Honor, is that his testimony that he was attempting to get Cholo to send someone to pick up the money. That was part of his work with the FBI, was to bring someone down to pick up the money. Cholo had repeatedly told Gregory Fulton that he was in fear of his life, that these individuals in Panama to whom he owed money were killers, more or less, and that he needed to get his money, that he would look to a friend or associate that he had who was from Baltimore and was presently in New York, and that was appellant, and that he would send him down to get the money. That was Fulton. And then, of course, the circumstances of the arrest of appellant himself, he came down, got into Fulton's car, had Cholo on the phone. Fulton confirmed with Cholo that appellant was his man, and got into the car. And then after appellant was arrested, he was found with the notebooks that had Barraza's phone number, Fulton's phone number, Cholo's new phone number was programmed into his cellular phone. He was clearly part of this network. I think it was really quite clear on the basis of this evidence.
If the evidence is as overwhelming as you're suggesting, all the more reason that the prosecutor should be damned for vouching.
Again, Your Honor, it was not artful phrasing, but I don't think that it alone was the cause of the jury's verdict. The jury's verdict was clearly based on the evidence in this case.
Okay. Further questions?
I see that my time's up. Any further questions from the court, or we will submit?
Thank you,
the evidence that the government characterizes as overwhelming here is that Mr. Brown was not seen or heard from in this drug conspiracy until the day he went down to pick up the money. And the court is absolutely right that the issue in this case was what was his intent when he did that. Now, the government says intent is a state of mind. So is there any other witness out there who could have rebutted his state of mind? We submit no. We submit that there's nobody else who can say what he knew when he went to get this money and what he meant to do when he went to get this money.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure what you're trying to argue. I mean, The government makes a circumstantial case of intent, right? There's no claim that Brown said, yeah, I intended to do this for purposes of drug peddling.
I was respecting.
And presumably that's a good deal more open to circumstantial questioning than the activity in Monahan.
I was referring to the court's reference to the Monahan case, Your Honor, and that to the reference that there would be other people who,
right,
to whom the prosecutor might be referring rather than the defendant when he characterizes,
right,
the case.
No, I understand, exactly.
But you
make the point that the government's case on intent is circumstantial, yeah, and that would invite one to think, well, probably the rebuttal case is going to be circumstantial.
I would submit that would still be burden shifting, Your Honor, if that's what the government did. But in this case, the way the case was tried, when both counsel referred to the fact that Mr. Brown's intent or Mr. Brown's state of mind was at the heart of the case, it seems to me that the clear import of that both position, the government and the defense, to the jury is nobody but Mr. Brown can come in and say what his intent was. And in fact, the prosecutor argues, and in his closing, with regard to Mr. Brown, his intent is unquestioned in this case. And that, to me, really drives home the point to the jury, and that's at the transcript at page 433, really drives home the point to the jury that no one else but Mr. Brown can counter the government's evidence as to his state of mind. The government claims that one piece of evidence of Mr. Brown's intent here is his relationship with Cholo. There's evidence in the record of a friendship with Cholo. There's absolutely no evidence of any participation between Mr. Brown and Cholo in drug activities. And in fact, on the day when Cholo needed somebody to come down and get the money, he called several other people. It's clear from the record that Mr. Brown was sort of a last-ditch effort. Came in at the last minute. He was supposed to get there at 1 o'clock. He got there at 5 o'clock. It was clear that he was sort of an afterthought to Cholo and not the person to whom he initially turned.
It's hard for me to see why that tends to show lack of intent.
I think it negates the government's argument that he was clearly related to Cholo in this illegal endeavor. There is evidence he's related to Cholo, but I submit there's no evidence that he's related to Cholo in this illegal endeavor. And it counters the government repeatedly argues that this case, the evidence is overwhelming, but when the court looks at the record, that's just not the case.
Any questions?
No. Thank you.
Ms. Pendry, you were appointed by the court to represent Mr. Brown in this case, and we very much thank you for your assistance.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case is submitted.